May it please the court. The first issue raised by the appellant concerns interpretation and or construction and or application of the language of an indemnity contract. The defendant, Mr. Layton, signed an indemnity agreement as an indemnitor. At the same time, he signed the same document with an application for a motor fuel tax bond for his employer, Dixie Management Group. The amount of the bond was $40,001. Later on, a change rider was issued to the bond, increasing it to $100,000. The indemnity agreement and the language from that is quoted at page 16 of the appellant's opening brief, provided in paragraph 2 that Mr. Layton agreed to indemnify Cincinnati against any liability, loss, and so forth from this bond or any other bond. Yes. Yes. Well, that as that turns out, that's not the case. But yes, and I would refer the court to FDIC versus Raymond, issued by a decision issued by this court, which is quoted from at page 6 and 7 of the reply brief. And in that case, and actually the appellee relies on that case for the argument, if there's a material change in the underlying obligation, then I shouldn't be held accountable for it. And in the FDIC versus Raymond case, Mr. Raymond, a loan guarantor, and the cases have treated loan guarantors and indemnitors in a somewhat similar fashion, had agreed to waive any notice of material changes in the underlying obligation, in this case the condition of the collateral. And at page 7 of the reply brief, I quote from Raymond, which says, one risk Raymond accepted is that the collateral would be damaged and consequently increased his risk. He expressly waived notice of that. Well, in this case, Mr. Layton also agreed to waive notice in paragraph 6 of the indemnity agreement of any change, alteration, or extension of any bond, including this bond, and agreed that the indemnity agreement would cover any subsequent bond of any type of the applicant. It wasn't canceled. No, certainly, the cancellation is a non-issue in this on this issue right here. A bond can be canceled for non-payment of premium with the Department of with the state of Illinois. That happened long after the obligations of the surety were above $100,000, and then was renewed when the premium was paid. It's a non-issue for this purpose. Yeah. A separate issue entirely, which the district court found was an issue of fact and denied the motion for summary judgment of my client, saying the argument that there's a novation, and by the way, the argument really is if you get a new indemnity agreement from any indemnitor, that's a novation and you've released all prior indemnitors. That's simply not the law. I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. The law on novations is that, and there's issues of fact as to whether there's a novation in this case, the law on novation is there must be an express release of the prior obligations as part of the new agreement for there to be a novation. The district court found that issues of fact existed on whether there was a novation, did not rule on those grounds. Beg your pardon, Judge? With respect to an indemnitor, that is simply not the case under the contract and under the law. When the indemnitor waived all notices A separate issue here is the indemnitor in this case knew about the change rider, in fact executed the change rider himself on behalf of Dixie Management. Well, as to what was much later, Judge Cudahy, I would say that the initial order by Judge Gorman was dated October 17. The judgment was issued on October 20 of 2003. 11 days later, Cincinnati filed a Rule 59 motion and a related motion to file an amended complaint which attached the executed change rider executed by... Well, either party could have done that, and this very late, Your Honor, is 11 days after the judgment. The initial position of Cincinnati was whether he knew about it or not doesn't matter. But if he did know about it, and it turns out he obviously did, that was raised before the Rule 59 motion was ruled on. Then it was raised separately 7 days after the Rule 59 motion was raised on in a rule under in a motion to for relief from the judgment under Rule 60B, which also attached a copy of the executed change rider executed by Mr. Layton. I understand, Judge Robner. I was not involved in the trial court proceeding. I don't know why it wasn't obtained earlier by either side, Mr. Layton or Cincinnati Insurance Company. Before this court, Mr. Layton doesn't claim that his affidavit, in which he said, I didn't know about the change rider, is true. What he claims in this court is, well, gee, at the time I signed my affidavit, I hadn't seen this stuff for 5 years, and, you know, I wasn't intending to mislead anybody. Whether he was intending to mislead anybody or not, he signed the change rider. Misrepresentation or misconduct, I submit to the court, is clear from the fact that this is the least issue of fact on that, because he filed discovery responses under oath. He filed an affidavit under oath saying, I didn't know about the change rider. Now that it's produced with his signature on it, he doesn't say I didn't sign it. He says, at the time I signed all of that, I didn't remember that I knew about it and had signed it. And under Section 60B, irrespective, and we have not represented to the court that we claim he defrauded somebody, whether he was negligent in filing the false affidavit or intentional, careless, or whatever, it was a false affidavit and he signed the change rider and clearly knew about it at the time it was issued, and that is grounds for setting aside the prior ruling under Section 60B. And it does require an abuse of discretion finding, and what we pointed out to the court, Judge Gorman ruled that, well, you didn't bring this to our attention sooner. I previously gave the court the timeline. As a matter of fact, there's at least arguably an issue as to whether his ruling on the Rule 59 motion was the final judgment, because he hadn't ruled on the motion to file the amended complaint. But in any event, 7 days after he denied the Rule 59 motion, a motion under 60B was filed, and pointing out that, in fact, Mr. Layton had signed the change application, and the standard there, which is in the last point of the opening brief I filed, is not whether the outcome would have been different, but whether or not. It says, the party seeking relief from a judgment based on fraud, misrepresentation, or misconduct of an adverse party must simply prove that it is entitled to a new trial by clear and convincing evidence. Well, if there were a new trial on whether or not he knew about the change rider, clearly he did. He's not coming forward and say, oh, somebody forged my signature on that. He was the managing person at Dixie Management Group at the time. Drobner, I'd... Well, Judge Robner, I would respectfully submit that if he signed it, that at the very least he was careless in signing an affidavit without bothering to find out whether he had signed it or not when the affidavit says I didn't sign it, and he signed discovery responses under oath saying that he hadn't signed it. There were three or four pleadings he signed saying he hasn't signed it, and since he's the one who signed it and would have knowledge of that, to claim that if they hadn't produced the signed copy and therefore he's free to file a false affidavit, I think would be turning it on its head. He certainly is bound by his knowledge that he signed it. Your Honor, we have not argued that he intentionally filed a false affidavit, but have argued he filed a false affidavit, and for purposes of 60B, it doesn't matter whether he did it intentionally or negligently or carelessly. He certainly had the means to go to the state of Illinois and get a copy himself. If he wanted to be sure before he signed an affidavit that he didn't sign it, he didn't do that. And clearly, the standard under Rule 60B here that on a new trial there would be clear and convincing evidence that the result would be different. Well, clearly it would be different if notice to him was required. He had notice. He doesn't claim that he didn't sign it before this court, which is a strong indication, of course, that he did sign it, and it appears that his signature looks the same. I do, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Margaret Gish. I'm here on behalf of Timothy Layton. May it please the Court. Your Honor, this appeal is about Cincinnati Insurance Company's failure to diligently investigate and present its case to the trial court, despite having 2 years to do so and multiple opportunities. Now Cincinnati is asking for yet another bite at the apple, and although they have met none of the standards for a reversal. Lack of diligence and waiver control the outcome of this case. I think the district court read that a reasonable person signing that indemnification, reading the contract as a whole in the context of a bond application, would not anticipate that the language used would be waiving notice of an increase so significant that it's 2.5 times the original liability. And that interpretation is a reasonable interpretation. Now, certainly, if you look at the Raymond case, totally different situation. In fact, the language in the waiver in Raymond is pivotal because it says, let me just find it here. The undersigned waives notice of acceptance of this guarantee, diligence, presentment, protest, notice of a dishonor, demand for payment, and any and all notices of whatever kind or nature and the exhaustion of legal remedies available to the holder of said note. That's a quotation. So clearly, language like that, one would conclude that even though it didn't say increase, any and all of whatever nature certainly would include an increase. In this case, the indemnification language is actually quite narrow. It says change, alteration, or extension. It doesn't say increase. It could have said increase. It doesn't say I waive notice of a new bond. I think the district court looked at the entire indemnification language, and in the context of change, alteration, or extension, reading that all together, concluded that it was not reasonable for Mr. Layton to have concluded that he was waiving notice of such a dramatic increase in his liability that it's 2.5 times the original amount. As he stated in his affidavit, Mr. Layton did not have the ability to do that. And he didn't have the ability because he didn't have the document in his possession telling him what he needed to do. He made efforts to cancel his liability, to find out what he needed to do. He contacted the only person with whom he had ever discussed anything about Cincinnati Insurance, Mr. Brent. The rule on agency is that the party's conduct, not the title, determines the relationship. In Farmers Auto Insurance versus Gittleson, a broker can act as an agent of the insurer or as an agent of both the insured and the insurer under certain circumstances, and it's the conduct that determines that. In this situation, Mr. Brent met with Mr. Layton after the his termination from the Dixie management. Mr. Layton told him, I don't have these documents. I need to make sure that I don't have any liability on these indemnifications that I signed. And Mr. Brent responded, I will make sure that that's not a problem. I will do it. He held himself out as being able to do so, and that was consistent with Mr. Layton's experience from the past. Both, actually. He did not recall signing anything, but when we finally looked at the rider itself, he was out of state on April 15th, the day it was signed. And I would also just remark that the Beelers, former partners that he had, have since pled guilty to 4 felony counts. It is not, Your Honor. But if Your Honor was asking me how he would respond to that particular question, there is, and he does, in his affirmative defenses to the complaint, assert that there was criminal conduct on the part of the dealers. So absolutely not, he did not sign it, and he would stand on his affidavit. Your Honor, we argue that I understand. A district court's decision can be held based on anything that's in the record. And in this case, the only evidence, the uncontroverted evidence before Judge Gorman, was that a new application was signed that had on it, effective December 30th, 1997. That new application represented itself to be a substitute contract. And also novation, the law says that it depends, again, on the circumstances and the facts surrounding them, how the parties act. So Cincinnati created a new document that said effective December 30th, 1997, and had the Beeler sign off on it and omitted Layton from it. The other act that Cincinnati did to support the novation is that when the default occurred, Cincinnati pursued only the Beelers, didn't make a demand ever on Layton until the lawsuit was filed. So from their actions, Cincinnati appears to have assumed or believed the new contract to be a substitute contract. And that would support Judge Gorman's decision. But the real issue, in our opinion, in this case, is the fact that Cincinnati failed to obtain one of the most critical documents in their case, this executed change rider. It's a document that was available, from what we can tell, from the beginning of the case. As early as April 2002, Cincinnati identified where the executed document could be found, and yet it never bothered to go get it. As early as April 2002, Cincinnati knew that Mr. Layton denied having any knowledge of it. So at that same time, they knew it was a disputed issue of fact, and it was their obligation to come forward with it. They did not do so. We would submit that it is not the defendant's job to track down documents that support the plaintiff's case. My client made very clear what his position is, and he had no knowledge of it, and he said that from the beginning. He has never changed his story. He did not have knowledge of it. He did not remember signing it, and he believes he did not sign it. So the obligation is on a plaintiff to present a full picture of their case to the trial court. And Cincinnati did not do this. In fact, they cavalierly made the assumption that the district court would follow its reading of the indemnification language, and that's why they didn't get it. They didn't think they needed it. But when the district court didn't follow their interpretation of the indemnification language, they decided, wait a second, we'll go out now and get some proof. But that's after judgment. And both Rule 59 and Rule 60B are not vehicles by which a party can present new evidence that was available prior to the judgment being entered. And this court has ruled on that time and time again. One of the errors that Cincinnati assigns to the district court is its treatment of Layton's Rule 12C motion, the motion for judgment on the pleadings. And we would respectfully submit that Cincinnati has waived this argument and that it should not be entertained by this court. That objection to the Rule 12C motion was not raised at the time of the motion. It was not raised in the Rule 59 motion, and it has been waived. But even if it was not waived, this Cincinnati's claim on this issue fails. Rule 12C specifically directs the district court to consider a motion for judgment on the pleadings as a motion for summary judgment. In this case, assuming it includes facts outside the pleadings. In this case, Mr. Layton filed a motion, 12C motion, which contained facts outside the pleadings. Cincinnati filed a response in which they made reference to these facts outside the pleadings. The court properly took it as a motion for summary judgment. And because this treatment was mandated by Rule 12, plaintiffs cannot now complain that it was surprised or prejudiced by it. But as stated earlier, it was never complained about in the court below, and it should not be relied on in this appeal. Cincinnati also alleges error in the denial of its Rule 59 motion, asserting that the change rider, the executed one, creates an issue of fact. However, they failed to bring that fact to the court's attention again. So their Rule 59 motion makes no comment, makes no indication that they have a copy of the executed change rider. So they've waived that argument as well. But even if the court were to consider it, their position is, well, the district court should have looked at the other pending motions. There was a motion to amend the complaint that had attached to it as an exhibit, the complaint, which had attached to it as an exhibit, the executed change rider. Well, they haven't provided us with any support for the proposition that the trial judge has to go searching through the record to find support for a Rule 59 motion or any other motion for that matter. And we don't believe that a court is obligated to scour the pleadings for support. In fact, it's the movement's obligation to present support for its argument. They didn't do so in this Rule 59 motion, and for that reason, this argument also fails. Their final allegation of error relates to the Rule 60B denial. The court denied the Rule 60B motion because it found that Cincinnati was not prevented from fully and fairly presenting its case. And that is a requirement to prevail in a Rule 60B motion, assuming there's an allegation of fraud, misrepresentation, or misconduct. This executed change rider, the crux of Cincinnati's case, was available to Cincinnati from, by Cincinnati's own admission, April 2002, a year and a half prior to the judgment. If Cincinnati had any doubt about Mr. Layton's position on the change rider, whether he was admitting or denying it, in April 2002, Mr. Layton responded to Cincinnati's request to admit facts and denied any knowledge of the change rider. Thus, as of April 2002, Cincinnati knew or should have known that it was a disputed issue of fact and should have gone about what a diligent plaintiff would have done to present its case, to preserve its rights. Cincinnati tries to argue that Layton should have obtained the rider. But, of course, there's no support for that proposition either, that a defendant has to go about finding support for a document that supports the plaintiff's case. The reality is Cincinnati was never prevented by Layton from fully and fairly presenting its case, from obtaining a copy of the rider. And by not doing so, Cincinnati wasted the trial court's time, it wasted Mr. Layton's time, and it's now wasting this court's time. With respect to the contract interpretation, the district court's reading of the indemnification language is that in the context of this bond application and indemnification, that this reading is reasonable. But even if we assume, for the sake of argument, that Cincinnati's reading is also reasonable, the guarantee, the law and guarantee, requires the guarantee to be interpreted against the guarantee, so in favor of the guarantor. Thus, again, regardless of how you read this, if there's any ambiguity, it is construed in favor of Mr. Layton, and so the district court's judgment should still be upheld. In short, Cincinnati Insurance has had multiple bites at the apple in the lower court. By virtue of its own lack of diligence, it has failed in each and every one. It has now failed to identify any sustainable error in the district court's decision. We urge this court to not reward Cincinnati's lack of diligence by giving it yet another bite at the apple. Thank you, Your Honor.
I please the court. First, I would point out to the court this case is here on a motion for judgment on the pleadings, which applies a Rule 12b-6 standard, whether the complaint states a cause of action or not. I would refer the court to R.J. Corman, Derailment versus International Union, 335 Fed 3rd 643 from this court, indicating that if a motion for judgment on the pleadings is going to be converted to a summary judgment motion, there must be some notice to the opposing party and a reasonable opportunity to respond to it as a summary judgment motion before it can be ruled on as a summary judgment motion. In this case, there was no such notice, and in fact, Judge Gorman, this is at pages 10 and 8 and 10 of the short appendix, his October 17 ruling points out that he's ruling on a motion for judgment on the pleadings. Never once does he say it's been converted to a summary judgment motion, nor did he ever apply that standard. In order to raise an affirmative defense, so to speak, an affirmative matter under a motion for judgment on the pleadings, it would have to be converted because you can't decide a motion for judgment on the pleadings on the basis of an affirmative defense, which was the case here. I would also point out that Mr. Layton has never asserted, after the executed copy of the change rider surfaced, that it was a forgery or he denied signing it. Never in briefs before this court, in pleadings in the trial court, he never once said that. There's nothing in the record in which once it was brought out that there was a signed change order that he claimed he didn't sign it. In hindsight, it would probably have been a good idea to have done that. Well, it was definitely brought to the attention of the court by the motion to amend the complaint and then separately attached to the motion under Rule 60B. Which followed 7 days after the ruling on the Rule 59 motion. I'm running out of time. On the oral release issue, agency cannot be created by the alleged agent and the alleged agent's conduct. Agency has to be created by something the alleged principal did. And in this case, an agent of an employee of an insurance agency is not automatically, as a matter of law, an agent of the insurance carrier or the surety. Thank you.